You are listening to an audio recording of a workshop session at the Gospel Coalition's 2016 Women's Conference.
Ladies, I am really glad to be here with you today. I'm Noelle Piper, and this breakout is about what we can learn from women in global ministries, global missions. It's sort of, the title is something sort of like the history, but I'm going to narrow it down a little bit today. Before I get started with that, I wanted to draw something to your attention. I hope you have noticed the Gospel Coalition's Packing Hope exhibit outside the exhibit hall here. In the last few months, I, through them, have gotten two Swedish language translation books to give away, and earlier last October last year, two titles to give to pastors and leaders that we were seeing in Uganda. Then they could have their pick of something in English or in Swahili. There are so many languages that have been books, really good, solid theological books, translated into lots of languages, and the cost of that is covered by donations. And if you are requesting books because you're going to go on a mission trip, what you have to pay is only the postage to have it shipped to you or to wherever it's going. However, you may have gotten this email that during the conference, that postage charge is being waived. So please go talk to the people at Packing Hope and find out about that kind of outreach to pastors who don't really have very much for theological resources. There's a stack of bookmarks up here on the chair at the corner afterwards you can pick up if you're interested to. Okay, this is a book that's a biography of five faithful women. So that's the title of the book, Faithful Women and Their Extraordinary God. I wanted to entitle it Ordinary Women and Their Extraordinary God, but one of the editors said he could never give that book to his wife because she would think that he thought she was ordinary. So I think that's a really good thing for a husband to feel, but I really also like knowing that God is working through ordinary people. Because I was thinking in wanting that choice for the book that what Jim Elliot said, that missionaries are... let me get this right. Missionaries are very human folks just doing what they're asked, simply a bunch of nobodies trying to exalt somebody. So today we are going to talk about what we can learn from biographies of faithful women, many of whom are missionaries. And I think somebody might ask how somebody's biography can help me when they live such a different place or time or life than I do. And here's what ties us together. We have the same God, and he's the same yesterday, today, and forever. And as you start reading about somebody whose life even is very different from yours, you might be surprised to find ways that your life crosses that woman's life, and something you learn from how she reacted in a certain situation. So I think here are some of the things I think about from quite different parts of the world. You know, our desire to do something the very best that we can, but the situation that we're in limits us to just good enough. Or you're a missionary woman far away from your home, and feels like all you're doing all day is the mundane, normal household things for your husband and kids that you could be doing back home. It would be so much easier there. And what difference is it making where I am? And to realize that you probably never will know the impact that your life will have through your husband, your children, people who are in your home. You won't see it, but you know that God is working like that. You'll hear probably most of the women whose biographies you would read say they're nothing special. They're just, they're too aware of their own weaknesses, and inabilities, and isn't that all of us? How do they deal with it? What does God show them? What do they do in spite of that? So I want to pray before we go further. Father, I pray that you would please give us eyes to see the crossings that there are that connect us to faithful women of other times and places, and that even more we would see you more clearly because of our time here today and because of the testimony of women whose lives we read about. In Jesus' name, amen. So, just a reminder that Hebrews 13, verses 7 and 8 is a good encouragement to read biography. Remember your leaders, those who spoke to you the word of God. Consider the outcome of their way of life and imitate their faith. Jesus Christ is the same yesterday and today and tomorrow. So, when you're reading biography, you're remembering people who've been your leader. They've led the way in the path ahead of you there. And you're considering their lives and imitating what you see of their faith because you have the same God as they do. I'm going to try to leave some time at the end for questions, so if you think of things, just jot it down, and I'll try to give you time there. So what I want to do today, instead of thinking about the history of global missions, or there's so many different good biographies or directions to go with biography, what I want to do today is narrow it down to one woman and let that woman represent what the kinds of thing we would see in other biographies we read too. The woman is Esther Nelson, and I know there's only a handful of you who even know who she is, who've ever heard her name, and those are the ones of you who've hung around with me long enough for me to talk about her to you, and that doesn't take very long before that happens. So here's the short version of who Esther Nelson is. She was born on a farm in Sweden in 1890. When she was 3, her family immigrated to Minnesota. In 1924, she was sent by First Swedish Baptist Church of Minneapolis to be a missionary in Sichuan in China. And she worked there from 1924 until 1951. She worked in several places, but all in Sichuan in West China. She returned to America only 3 times during those 26 or 7 years. The travel from Minneapolis to Sichuan took her 3.5 to 4 months. Train across America, ship across the Pacific, and then ever smaller and smaller boats up the ever smaller and smaller rivers until she reached her destination. When she wrote a letter, it would be weeks at least, and maybe months, before she would receive a reply to that letter. So I find that kind of perspective helpful when I'm frustrated that I'm not hearing from somebody that I emailed 3 days ago, you know. While she lived there, China was undergoing tumultuous changes. She arrived in the mid-1920s when the warlords were still competing for their territory. So she never knew when there would be fighting in the streets of her town, and maybe they'd wake up tomorrow morning with a different general in charge of their area now. There were periods of anti-foreign reaction when she and other missionaries would evacuate from where they were far in the interior and go out to Shanghai to wait until things had settled down and they could go back. There came years of the Japanese trying to get a foothold in China, and that might mean there would be bombing of the village or town where you were living. Mao's long march passed by within miles of the hospital where she was working at the time, and their hospital halls, floors, every space would be filled with people who were being treated for injuries and skirmishes out in the hills. Bandits roamed the countryside, and then there were years of civil war in China ending with the rise of Mao Zedong and the communist government in control. She worked as a nurse most of her years in China, and then finally, in 1947, when she went back at that time, she was able to do what she had been longing to do for many years, and that was to work full-time as an evangelist with women, children, trekking out miles into the countryside. She was, countryside means steep mountains. She was in a very remote area of China, and they were trying to reach the Nosu, who were one of the of China's minority peoples. That joy was brought to an end all too soon when the communist government commanded all foreigners to leave the country. The route that she and her co-workers considered to be the safest way for them to get out required them to walk about a week over some of the steepest mountains I've ever seen. So you consider that they're on the western side of China, next to Tibet, Himalayas. You just sort of think what kind of territory there is there. A young mother in their group died during that time, probably of meningitis. And then Esther, for the rest of the trek out, helped that father with that with their 10-month-old baby and the other children until they could get to Hong Kong. And at that point, although all the missionaries in that group had come by ship to China, as Esther had, the mission flew the father and his children back to get them back to America and their extended family as soon as possible, and Esther went with them to help him. So that was the only time she ever flew across the Pacific. So that she arrived back in Minneapolis in 1951 at the age of 61. When she walked into church the first Sunday after she arrived back, people stood and cheered and clapped, sounds that I'm sure that old Swedish sanctuary had never heard before. It might be Minneapolis, but it was still very much Swedish personality. My husband became pastor of that church in 1980, which by now was named Bethlehem Baptist Church, and Esther had died in 74, so I never met her. Sometime in our early years there at Bethlehem, some storage areas were being cleared out, and a box was uncovered that was filled with papers and photographs and letters, all the letters that had been received at the church from Esther. And, you know, to the pastor, to Sunday school classes, to missionary circles, and to her excellent friend Elsie, who was the church secretary for decades, covering most of the time. She started at the church slightly after Esther went to China, so during almost all of her years, Elsie was her close friend and confidant. So I saw that box and I said, I bet there's a story there. And it took a long time to get to it, but for the last few years, I've been working on putting Esther's story together, including a month in China, visiting the places where she worked. And then last month, I spent a week in southern Sweden in the community where she had been born. One feature of the farms in southern Sweden cannot be missed, and that is the most massive boulders you can imagine. Buried in the ground, you know, like icebergs, 9/10 underground and sticking up plenty high. I wrote about it in my blog called tellmewhentopack.com. I'm not going to read the whole thing to you, but it struck me when I saw those that God, which we know, but here was a picture of it, God was preparing for Esther's call to China. Since the Ice Age, at least. Well, we know he's preparing everything before the beginning of time, but the Ice Age is far enough ago that it really hits you how far back it is. You know, so the glaciers during the Ice Age are shoving these giant boulders along like they're pebbles, and then comes, you know, the global warming, and the glaciers start to melt and leave southern Sweden embedded with truck-sized rocks. So when you're farming there, You move the little ones and you make miles and miles of stone walls surrounding your fields, but you can only go so high with those. You build your barn out of stone. You make the foundation of your house out of stone. You know, there's not so much more you can do with stone except pile the ones you can move over in the corner of a field somewhere. And then still there are the ones that are too massive to move. So even nowadays, farmers with tractors leave them in the barn if they're in those fields and use the scythe to cut the hay for their animals because you have to get around those rocks. So sometime early in the 1800s, Nils Nilsson moved to Koroboda, and there were a cluster of three or four farms there in the parish of Churkholt in the county of Blekinge in Sweden. Now, we know Nils's father was named Nils because Nils's name is Nils Nilsson. And since his father was also Nils Nilsson, that means there was an earlier Nils. So, you know, maybe the Nils Nilssons go back almost to Adam, I'm not sure. But after a while, in the late 1800s, that Nils Nilsson's sons had all moved to America except for Sven. And so Sven was farming with his father. And in 1890, Esther was born. So she was the fifth child of Sven and Johanna Maria. It might be that the addition of that child to the family was the final stone in the burden that Sven carried to take care of his family, because the next year he went to an auction, bought himself a used coat and a blanket, because he was going to go to America and Johanna Maria was going to need the blanket they'd been using at home. And then 2 years later, she and the children came and joined him in Minneapolis. So they all were here in Minneapolis by 1893. So there's God working in his mysterious ways using the Ice Age to get Sven Nilsson out of southern Sweden and into Minneapolis. And he knows how he's going to get you from where you are right now to where he wants you to be. So what I want to do today is walk through a couple of things that Esther wrote. And along the way, I'll interject some thoughts I want to do two things with this. One is to let Esther's story answer some questions you may be asking about your own life and direction and calling. And the second thing is just simply to give an example of me reading a biography and looking for ways that my life crosses with a faithful woman who's gone before me. So I'm going to start with Esther's testimony. She didn't want to write her testimony because she didn't feel like anybody would really want to read her testimony, but one of her friends at First Swedish Baptist asked her to do it so it could be read to the Young Women's Missionary Society. About my life, it has always been so simple. God has never allowed me to want in any way. I've had no special hardships or trials. Now let that soak in. Warlords, she's writing this well into her time. She's writing it up, you know, probably in the 1940s, so she's been there 20 years. Warlords, bombs, evacuations, and then as you get a little further in her testimony, poverty when she was a child, an alcoholic father. So she says no special hardships, and I think she may be thinking about situations she's seen that look so much more difficult than hers. And certainly she would have been thinking about the suffering of her Savior, her Redeemer, and that making her hardship seem insignificant. She talks about her early years in Minneapolis. I remember a small white church. It would be a Lutheran church because her parents were from Sweden, and at that time, if you were Lutheran, you wouldn't have gone to anything but a Lutheran church, if you were Swedish and Lutheran. I remember a small white church on South 6th Street where I went to Sunday school. All I remember from this time was my love for the Sunday school and church, and that I was called to go into a foreign country as a missionary. I knew I was not saved and that I must be before I could go. Have you ever heard that testimony before? I was called to be a missionary, so I needed to become a Christian. That is to say that God is not restrained to some few patterns of how he calls people to himself. And, you know, I ask myself as I hear her story, and you may too, whether she wasn't really already a Christian because she's seeking so hard to follow him, but that's not the way she calls it. So I'm just going to read it to you as she said. I do remember a sweet young woman who was my Sunday school teacher. I do not recall her name, but wish I could thank her for all that she had meant to me during those early years. There are some of you here who feel like what you're doing is just so regular and so insignificant, it can't possibly be having any influence on anybody. That woman never knew the impact she had on one little girl, and through that little girl, to the world. But God knew, and God was working. So take that to heart. From the time I can remember, I planned to go to Africa. Yep, she said Africa. I know the desire was always there. When a child, I just simply thought I was never going to marry or settle down, for I was going to Africa. She never did marry, and her letters, even to her good friend Elsie, never seemed to regret it. In fact, there are some times when she is very thankful for the fact that she is freer to do some things that her married colleagues are not able to do. But perhaps it's not so settled for some of you. And so I'm going to step aside from Esther a minute and tell you a story. A few years ago, a young woman at our church said to me, "I am moving toward missions, but my family is pressuring me to stay in America until I meet somebody and get married, because when I go overseas, there won't be anybody there." And my mouth speaking before my brain said, "If there's nobody there, why are you even going?" But I know that's not what they meant. So, then my brain went into action better. So I said, "If God wants you to be married, geography isn't going to stop him. And the second thing is, if he is drawing you toward missions, keep walking the direction that he's pulling you." Now, a few years after that, she was in Pakistan doing relief work after an earthquake, and she met there the man that she married. Now, here's the punchline. They were both from our church. And they are still in global ministry together now in a hard place. Esther goes on, "We were a large family. Times were hard. We were poor. Mother had to work to help support us. Father drank quite heavily at that time, but mother tried to make up to us for everything. I will say this over and over again. God is not stopped by a difficult family background. He is working in you and in your family in some way, but that does not stop him from doing what he intends to do through you. We lived in Minneapolis until I was about 11 years of age, and then we moved to the farm. They tell me I was an odd child, so very, very shy and very, very quiet. Perhaps you are worried, I think, because you don't have the personality that you think would be really good for being in a particular ministry or kind of mission. But what is the right kind of personality for being a missionary or ministering? God created you with the personality you have, and yes, all of us, he's through our whole life, he's knocking off some of the sharp edges of our personality, and it's called sanctification. But your question is, how does he want to use the personality he has given me? People who knew Esther as an adult say she was socially awkward, quiet, staying in the background, but that was while she was in America. Think of the guts it took to launch out to China on her own. I mean, she was under a mission board, but she wasn't going as part of a team, and to leaving behind everything she'd ever known. And then when she got to China, you see in her letters that she blossoms and becomes bold for Christ. When she was where God had intended all this time to take her, he made her the woman fit for that place. "From the time I awakened to my own condition, my one goal was to find Christ, for otherwise, how could I go to Africa? Mother seemed to sense it. We were so close, but always before me was the time that I would have to bid her farewell. Mother would often say I was to take care of her when she was old. I longed to throw my arms around her and say, 'Yes, Mother, I will,' but I couldn't do that. How could I?" And isn't that a struggle for so many? How to honor parents and love them, and at the same time to follow God's leading in our lives. Esther wouldn't make promises that she knew she couldn't keep. Night and day, I would talk to God. At times, I would blame God for allowing me to be born in a non-Christian home. Yes, they were Lutheran, and yes, they had done the perfunctory church things, but she didn't consider them to be a Christian family. Why had he not given me Christian parents so that I could have found the way? I had my special little corners where I would go and talk to him where I wouldn't be found. Nothing pleased me more than when in the spring and fall I was sent to herd the cattle. I would climb up on a fallen tree or stump and read my Bible and sing and cry and pray. I could not understand why I couldn't find Christ. Sometimes I tried to make myself think he didn't care for me. I was too wicked. In my heart, I knew he did care. Other times, I wondered if in blaming God, I had committed some terrible sin so that he had cast me aside. Time and again, I would cry myself to sleep at night. In rain or shine, Sunday or evenings, if there were services, I went to church. There were times when the folks tried to keep me home, but I would slip off. The 3 miles seemed like only a couple of blocks. At about 13 years of age, I joined the pastor's Bible class. I was so happy. Now, surely, I would find Christ. And then I could go to Africa and tell them of my wonderful Savior. That fall, we had revival meetings, and an older schoolmate was converted. I'd never seen that happen before. When I came home, I prayed God that he would do the same for me. I was sick at heart. Was I an outcast? I was on the farm from 11 years old until 17 when I went to Minneapolis to work and to find Christ so that I could go out and tell the story. Minneapolis, I thought, that's where I'll find Christ. I would be so happy to come home a Christian after a few months. Time came for me to go back home, and I was the saddest girl in all of Minneapolis. Maybe next year I could go back and maybe I would find Christ. And she did go back the next fall. A certain Thursday afternoon, God did answer my prayer. I had a telephone call from Anna Anderson, who was from our town near the farm. She too was there to work. She was a Baptist, and I'd always said I could never be a Baptist, which sounds funny to us now, but you have to realize that at that time, the Swedish Lutherans considered Baptists to be a heretical sect. So it would be a serious thing to step out of the Lutheran church and become a Baptist. She asked me if I would like to go with her to prayer meeting. I almost cried with joy. I forgot to ask at what church. And I never thought of it then or even afterwards. I was so happy to go to a church again. How I feasted. 2 or 3 months later, I gave my heart to the Lord in our own church basement. How I loved that place. How happy, how free I was. I had given my all to Christ. He asked me to follow him. I was ready and willing to obey. Then I wrote Mother and Dad, and they felt so bad. I couldn't hurt her so. Was it necessary after all? God knew my heart. He knew I was willing. However, no matter what excuses I made to myself, my heart told me I was wrong. Christ had asked me to follow him. I was disobedient. How could one like that ever think God wanted her to go to Africa? Maybe guilt is holding you back, and you fear, as Esther did, that God couldn't possibly want you to go. How could he ever send me? Even faithful women have their weaknesses. And a good biography is going to talk about those. And in Esther, we see somebody who falls over and over again into these introspective times that leave her blaming herself and maybe for real sin and maybe being oversensitive. But that's between her and God. But then at the end of it, her guilt covers up what she knows is true about God. That God can really use her, that she forgets her standing with God sometimes in those times. About a year slipped by before I finally followed my Lord and stepped down to be buried with him in baptism, the joy that now flooded my soul. Now I was free to accept his call to foreign lands. I felt as though earth had become a paradise. I must prepare for Africa. I had not gone beyond high school, so I went to Bethel Academy and spent 3.5 glorious years there. Now, sometimes the steps that God leads us through in preparation are really giant strides. Esther became the first person in her family, probably for all the generations past, to receive education beyond maybe high school, most of them just basic grade school years. And so that was a giant step for her. Father was sick, and I went home to help care for him. He died after 2 weeks. At the time of my father's passing away, I thought of giving up further education to take care of mother, as she had always said that I should not go away but stay with her, though I had three other sisters. Five children came from Sweden, and then two more were born after they came to Minnesota. I was at a crossroads. Which direction should I go? Then she had a dream in which she heard her father calling her voice, and she saw him standing at the door in his traveling clothes, his hand on the doorknob, and he said, "Esther, what you're going to do, do soon." So she said, I knew what that meant. Africa had become covered in a sort of mist. I went to Minneapolis and went to visit Mrs. Young, a member of the Women's Foreign Board, and I asked about going at once. She told me there was no opening, but she advised me to train as a nurse because they were building three hospitals in Africa, and I would be getting done about the time they'd be ready to staff those hospitals. So I went to the Swedish hospital to apply and entered there that fall for nursing. Now, I can imagine some of you feeling discouraged because the preparation that's recommended for what lies ahead is going to take so long. Then look at Esther. You need nurses? Thank you and goodbye. I'm going to Swedish Hospital to sign up. And that would be 2 more years at least before she could go. And then take this into account. She was over 30 by the time she started nurses training, way older than any of the other women who were training for nursing. And by the time she actually sailed for China, she was 34, which at that time seemed very old for launching out and doing something so crazy. Whoever does that? I graduated but heard nothing from the board about going, so I accepted a position in the hospital. Mother was in Minneapolis now living with one of my sisters, and now she goes into another time of doubting. Maybe she heard God's call wrong. Maybe he didn't want her. And the kinds of things you've heard her saying before. Maybe my not getting to go was my punishment. I took it as such and tried to make the best of it. And I think that kind of question comes up for a lot of us, especially when there's a change lying ahead, when things aren't moving forward as we had hoped they would. Did I make a mistake about where God is leading me? Is he closing this door so that I'll go a different direction? Is it not yet quite the right time for the next step? And any of those questions and the answers to them might be the right question and the right answer. That's between you and God. But like Esther, it would be a good thing to ask whether there is sin holding me back that I need to repent of so that I'm ready to go. And then not like Esther in letting that sense of guilt grow bigger than the truth you know about God, that he is sovereign and his timing is perfect. Mother was never for my going. She passed away in 1939 during my furlough. Family that doesn't understand what you're moving into, that's an issue for a lot of people. Esther loved her mother. They had been close, but she went anyway. She wasn't callous about it, though. Her mother was already living comfortably with one of Esther's sisters, the same sister that Esther would live with when she was home in America. And also, as Esther left, she gave a special charge to her friend Elsie to take special watch, to keep special watch over her mother. So Elsie was a conduit for messages between the two of them and would just go to visit her mother. All the time I fought against going, I knew I would not be content not to go. What an odd makeup. I am so glad God knows my heart and understands me. And there's part of her answer to her sense of guilt that would want to overwhelm her, the comfort that God knows her heart and understands her. And then she ends, I wish I could write you something worthwhile in place of telling you about a sinful life, but it has been redeemed, washed in the blood. Oh, the glorious Christ, my Christ and yours. And I say, what she's written is not worthwhile because it's a sinful life. Well, what does your testimony look like? What does mine look like? That's all of us. And it's exactly the story we need to hear from her and the story that we can tell others to show how Christ works. Now, there's a page missing near the end of her testimony, and that would be where she wrote about how she turned from looking toward Africa and ended up going to China. So we don't know what happened there. We know how the Ice Age got her out of Sweden, but we don't know how she ended up going to China. But we do know that because she had been thinking about Africa, she got the nurse's training that fit her to be part of the earliest programs for training nurses in West China. In other words, God may move in mysterious ways, but he does perform his wonders as he chooses. Now, moving on to one other thing she wrote. When Esther wrote to Elsie, she would tell the real story. She would write very carefully, as many missionaries do when they're writing to all of their prayer supporters, people who aren't necessarily going to understand every little thing. She wrote very politely, more closely, but more politely when she wrote to the pastor and his wife. They were her friends, but you have to have a certain decorum, she felt, when you're writing to your pastor. In fact, I'll just give you a little. Elsie was still at Bethlehem. Her friend Elsie was still at Bethlehem when we came there, and she would not quit calling me. She's going up to her 90s. I'm in my 30s. She would not call me anything but Mrs. Piper, because that's what you call the pastor's wife. Okay, so there's decorum. All right, there's no decorum when she's writing to Elsie. She can write whatever she wants to her friend. And so one of the things about biography is I love a good story. And this letter is one of my favorites. And on this one, I'm going to try not to interrupt, because I want you to be listening and thinking for yourself what you hear there, what you see, what you notice about Esther, how it might cross with your life. And so I'm just going to give this the sort of under the heading of adjusting to a life you never imagined you could stand. And now, I'm not going to ask you to raise your hands and embarrass you, but I know there must be some nurses here in the room, and I'm not going to call you personally paranoid, but I'm just going to mention that often nurses are the people who know way too much about germs and their consequences. Esther was a nurse. Keep that in mind here. So it's 1933. She's traveling by river. The boat, as far as I can tell, must have been just basically maybe a raft kind of thing. It's packed with soldiers being transported and people trying to escape danger in their home villages. She writes to Elsie, I wish I could picture this to you. There's no need to say I dreaded it. I could not feature myself spreading my cot along with men and women, mostly men, and heaps of them, dirty in every way, and sleeping, eating, living with them for 4 days and nights. Usually that kind of boat has no toilets except to sit over the edge of the boat. Imagine my doing that with 50 or more folks watching. Ha ha, she says. Well, I knew I couldn't. I would starve for 4 days instead. Of course, we always carry what we call our best friend, the chamber pot, but where and how to use it? However, I'm getting along better than I ever expected. She's actually writing from the boat. They had a toilet and someone said it was fine. Ha ha ha. Glad they thought so. So anyway, there is one next to the kitchen, and the least said the better, but I'm not fasting. It's strange, really. I can't explain it, Elsie. I could never stand anything like this at home. As much as I dreaded it when I started, the minute I got on the boat, all had disappeared. I had no fear, no disgust, but felt perfectly free and happy. There are 7 women, 3 or 4 children. The rest are all men, all spread on the floor except myself, as I have my army cot. two soldiers on my right, so close we rub elbows all the time. To my left is a long cupboard, and on the top of that, which is a little higher than my cot, a couple of men are sleeping. The only fear I have is that they may forget an expectorate on my bed or me. There is a path between them and me about 4 inches wide, but they might miss that. And then she laughs again, ha ha. Great life if you don't weaken. We each live on our own little spot, I on my cot. Wash, eat, sleep. I'm public property now. Of course, I never undress, but sleep in my clothes. And I wonder about my clothes and me, for you realize all around me are bugs for the body and the head. Oh well, I'll wash up and sterilize myself when I arrive. I'm having a good time. A woman asked to use my wash basin. I let on that I didn't understand her, for I didn't like for her to use it. However, a boy got it out and let her have it. But she noticed I sort of felt, well, not so quick to respond, so I think her feelings were hurt, which I did not want. Well, I decided if God can protect me living as I do and not get all their diseases, he'll protect me even if they use my wash basin. Hereafter, I shall try to do better if I want to teach them anything about Christ. I'm sure he would not have hesitated. So after she arrives, she writes still a little more about the trip. And I hear this as a reminder that all of life is life, not preparation and then life, not travel on the boat and then life. I had a happy time and made several friends, especially some children who I became very fond of and who seemed to think I was just it. We played writing games and guessing games, sang songs and hymns, all on my cot, which was full of folks most of the time. I loaned my Chinese Testament to one young man. When he and his wife left, they asked me if they could keep it, and I said if they promised me that they would read it, they could. They said they would. And then she says again how she can't get over how God put such peace and contentment in her heart during those few days. When I started out, I was afraid I would simply be out of my mind by the end of the trip, but not a thing bothered me. I know it was God who took all such out of my heart and gave me the sweet contentment and joy. I know I never could have stood it otherwise. And now here's a little glimmer of the blessing of having a confidant that you could write to as she did to Elsie. This is at the end of the letter from the boat. Elsie, this letter is not for public, remember. And don't tell my mother. Okay, I have a few other examples of questions and things that she wrote, but what I want to do, I think, right now is stop and let you ask questions about Esther's life or about questions that you have that I can try to answer from Elsie, from Esther. Go ahead and speak nice and loud. That's right. I think in those moments, did she feel like God couldn't use her because she had sinned, but we are all sinners? I think in those moments, she was thinking of some particular, what she felt like was a sin, like having blamed God for not letting her be born into a Christian family, or because her parents were upset that she had become a Christian in a Baptist church, and that let her waver in her thoughts about whether she should actually go to the mission field. Then she would feel guilt because she felt herself pulling away from what she knew was God's will for her. So in those times, she's talking about some particular thing that she feels might be separating her from God. Not that she's a sinner in general. What kind of sin do you think would take you away from what God wants you to do? I think when I spoke of that, I was thinking of what, you know, in older days might have been called a besetting sin, some habit you have, some way that you regularly speak to people in a way that is not helpful. It could be something big, it could be something small. Something that you have not been able to overcome in your life, or maybe you haven't given it enough thought how to overcome it. And So that's the kind of thing I mean, that God may want to sanctify that out of your life so that you are more ready to go. Yes? Have you finished the book? Okay, true confession. I've been having so much fun doing the research. It's like being a detective, and I do love detective stories. So I will turn 69 in December, and I have told my husband, who will hold me to my word, that I intend to finish it before I'm 70. So now I've told all of you. Recommendations of biographies. One that comes to my mind, first of all, that I think is written masterfully is by Elizabeth Elliot, and it's called A Chance to Die, and it's the biography of Amy Carmichael. And the reason that I think it is such a good book, well, of course, Elizabeth Elliot is an excellent writer, and Amy Carmichael was an amazing woman, but I could see two things as I'm reading through this book. I could see why Amy Carmichael was one of Elizabeth Elliot's heroes. And at the same time, I could see she would have been dreadfully difficult to live with and work with. I could never have worked with Amy Carmichael. So Elizabeth Elliot could write about both of those things and help you see both of those. Anybody else want to just shoot out some answers of biographies, particularly of women? Yes. Yes. So Dr. Ida, about Ida Scudder, who founded a hospital in India. Shoot out another one. Yes, there are two of you here. Go ahead, whatever.
I was going to say Isabel Kuhn.
Isabel Kuhn, there are several. Is there?
By Searching is her first one.
What is it?
By Searching?
By Searching. Okay. Isabel Kuhn, Kuhn, who was a missionary in southern China, southwest China. Fierce Convictions by
Karen Swallow Pryor.
That reminds me of one that I would recommend called Evidence Not Seen by Darlene Diebler-Rose. Any of the books by Helen Rosevere, many of them are autobiographical. By the way, I would just mention, I haven't heard recent word, but the last I heard a few weeks ago, she's failing rapidly. She must be close to 90. So as you think about her, pray for her easy entrance to her Savior. Yes?
I don't know if Gladys Aylward wrote any books, but she's interesting.
Gladys Aylward is a good one to read about. She's one of the people, and so is Helen Rosevere, who are in this. So this one actually, each chapter is one relatively short biography, so it can be kind of a jumping off point, Faithful Women and Their Extraordinary God. And, you know, if you get interested in somebody, then you can go look for some of the other books that tell you more about that person. The most well-known book about Gladys Aylward is called The Small Woman. I was on the mission field. I've made a lot of mission trips. I've never lived on the mission field, but I do love to go visit people and see what God's doing in all sorts of places. Way at the back. I need you to speak more loudly. The Life of the Three Mrs. Judsons by Arabella Stewart. Yeah, the story, and you know, along with that, you'll get the story of Adoniram Judson, who was really a pioneer, the kind of missionary who went and intended to live where he worked until he died. Yes. My Heart in His Hands about Ann Judson. So now I should get back to if there are any questions, or also you can, if you want to mention more books. So, yes.
I wanted to ask, you mentioned Esther Nelson had come home three times. What were those reasons?
She came home, and she would stay home for 2 or 3 years. So I don't know specifically, but she arrived in China at the beginning of 1925. She came back in 1920 to America in 1929, and then returned in 1932 to China. So it might have just been because it was a good time to come for a break and for a refreshment. And she does thank the church profusely for how refreshed she feels going back, because of the prayer times together, the friendships, the singing from the choir, the good preaching. She just goes in a long list of all the ways that the church was her good support. And I take that as an encouragement at a personal level, as well as at a church level, of caring for our missionaries. She came home in 38 and stayed until 1940. That was the time during which her mother died. I don't think she came home because of her mother's health, but I'm not sure of that. She came home in 1945, I think because she was ready to get out of the mission board she was with, whose work was only institutional, schools and hospitals. And like I said, she really wanted to be doing evangelism. And that was the time she was with the North American Baptists, which was who a lot of the Swedish Baptists went with. But that was in the mid-40s was when the Swedish Baptist Convention of America, which is what our church was part of, started their own mission board. They became the Baptist General Conference, and they had their own mission board. So she joined that. It was also the same time that the Conservative Baptist Mission Board was formed to try to pull into a more conservative theology. So that was a crucial time in missions as well. Way back there. Do I encounter many women who are in the, you know, the another later chapter of life who are just now entering missions? Yes, there are more and more people, sometimes going for a year or two to do some kind of support work, like helping out with the guest house or doing accounting work or the kind of support things that lets the missionaries be free to the other missionaries be free to do what they've been called to do more directly. Yes, more and more. And in fact, one friend of mine became a missionary to Brazil when she was 50 or 50-something, went down, learned the language, knowing she was going to live there. And so that was a career change for her, and that's been really hard for her and really amazing and good how God has worked, too. Okay, somebody else had, let's see, you had your hand up next, I think. Specific fruitfulness in her mission work. I am so glad you asked about that, because that was one of the things I did want to be sure to say, because I know that for the ones of you who have been in missions and ministry sometimes, or maybe the whole period of your work, can be really discouraging because it feels like there's not much response. And at the end of that time, when she and the other missionaries had to leave the country, they were leaving behind about 25 people who they considered to be a relatively strong core of the small church. But they had no idea. They feared for what life was going to be for them under the communists. And Esther died in 1974 before China opened up so that we could know what God was doing there. So when she died, as far as she knew, there may not even be any Christians left in China. All of the missionaries, I think it's safe to say that all of the missionaries who had to leave then, which was all the missionaries who were there, had that same kind of anxiety for the church they were leaving behind. So I ran across in the library of a Christian college two books that represent what we expected and what really happened. So there was a doctoral dissertation that was written in the 1970s that was called something like Why Christianity Didn't Take Root in the Soil of China. And then in the early 90s, after China had opened and we realized what God had been doing, raising up millions of Christians, there is the book that's called China's Christian Million. So just those two titles of what we didn't know but thought we knew and what we did know. And I hear that as a great affirmation that God often chooses to work through us where we are so that we can see what's happening. But that's not the only way he works. In China, he worked because we left. We left and the Christians depended totally on God. And so God works in different ways, and China is an amazing story that's different than the way Christianity grows up in many different places. So I think we have time for a couple more questions. Yes. Okay, let me name one at a time. Free on Kindle, A Retrospect by James Hudson Taylor.
Written his own words.
And The Story of John G. Patton. The Story of John G.
Patton. It looks like John Gibson Patton wrote it.
So it might be his own words then. And Patton is spelled P-A-T-O-N. Anybody else with anything, question or suggestion? Did she do any more ministry after she came back? Is that the question? She went to work again at Swedish Hospital, which meant she could live in the nurse's residence there. She had family around, and you know, I didn't even mention them, but a lot of times in her letters to Elsie, she was asking, did my brother ever come to church? Did his wife ever come to church? I hope they might at least come at Christmas. So she had a great burden for her family. Not only was she the first one to get high school and further education, she, at that generation, may well have been the only one who was a believer. So in the last quite a few years of her life, she moved into dementia, and it was really kind of a sad, to look at it, a sad anticlimax to the life that she had had before. But she had a lot of friends, who and Elsie and others, who stayed close with her. Okay, this is the last one.
On my blog, Abby's Arrow Adventures, it's A-B-I-S, Abby's Arrow Adventures, there is an inspiration tab, and it has a whole list of pioneer tribal mission books.
Excellent. So Abby's what adventures?
Arrow, like arrow.
Oh, Abby's, A-B-I, apostrophe S or just S? A-B-I-S, Arrow Adventures. A-R-R-O-W-E-D, Adventures. And she has a list of biographies listed there. So that would be really helpful. I'm going to stay here a little longer if you want to come up to talk some more, but I want to let you go free for the what's happening next. What I want to end with is a beautiful blessing, benediction, that Esther wrote to her church as she was sailing away from San Francisco one of the times. And you fit in the people and places that you love here. Finally, brothers and sisters, fare thee well. Be perfect. Be of good comfort. Be of one mind. Live in peace. And the God of love and peace shall be with you. That's from 2 Corinthians 13. Fare thee well, my dear, dear church. Farewell, Minneapolis. Farewell, Minnesota, land of 10,000 lakes. And farewell, USA. As I leave you waving farewell, I turn, and on the other side, there is the waving and beckoning of welcome, my chosen people. May God bless you.